it's a very special speaker, and I will introduce him at some length because I think it's important we recognise some of his enormous achievements. I'm delighted that His Royal Highness Prince Al-Hassan bin Talal of Jordan is here to speak to us. He's a direct descendant of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and is the brother of His late Majesty King Hussein and the uncle of King Abdullah II of Jordan. He was the Crown Prince in Jordan from 1965 until 1999. He's a staunch campaigner for the rights of all to live in peace and dignity. His Royal Highness is a pioneer of the interfaith dialogue, along with Evelyn Rothschild, another member of my advisory board, and Prince Hassan's international commitments have included co-chairing the Independent Commission on International Humanitarian Issues and his current membership of the Commission on Legal Empowerment of the Poor. Prince Hassan has had a long active engagement with environmental organisations, having recently served as the chairman of the United Nations Secretary General's Advisory Board on Water and Sanitation. Prince Hassan currently chairs the High-Level Forum for the Blue Peace Middle East Plan. He established the Arab Thought Forum, the Royal Institute for Interfaith Studies, the Higher Council for Science and Technology, and the Royal Scientific Society and the West Asia North Africa Institute. So he has a very considerable set of recommendations for him being here to speak to us today. He's, I think he would allow me to say, an old friend of mine from many years ago, and I'm delighted that His Royal Highness has agreed to speak to us. He'll talk to us for about half an hour, and then we'll open it again to the floor to ask questions or make comments. Your Royal Highness.
I'd like to thank you, Michael, for your generous introduction. And when it comes to old, I'm not entirely sure whether you're referring to our age or the duration of our friendship, but I will attest to the fact that we are firm friends and would like to thank you for referring to another friend in the audience, I won't say old again, to Evelyn, with whom I had the privilege, along with Prince Philip, in starting that particular phase of the St. George's House consultations. I came here to address the subject of standing on the shoulders of giants, commemorating the first Arab awakening. This year is the 100th year of the Arab Nahda, or the Arab awakening. And so we coincide with celebrations of different initiatives. We're in the National Liberal Club, and I came here to speak of the liberal ideas that actually contributed at the turn of the 19th to the 20th century in the manifesto of the Al-Fatat nationalist platform, which might interest you to know, read along the following lines. You are Arabs before you are Muslims, before you are Christians, and before you are Jews. The land is your land, and the fatherland is your fatherland, and we must join together to defend its independence. The document ended with a detailed program, the Arab Independence Program, Barnamij al-Istiqlal al-Arabi, which was to be the statement of their demand to the Allies at the peace conference in Paris. Of course, meeting of Arab thought and thinkers included Jews, Christians, and Muslims of Arab culture. Today you could talk about Arabs of Jewish culture, possibly, if you imagine the conversation between Ibn Khaldun and Maimonides. But I do want to dispel the notion that in some way we are not a direct descendant of a Semitic culture which we share. So I would like to point out that the tolerance of that time, the mutual respect of that time, is what we seem to have lost. Maybe this is a blinding flash of the obvious, and I'll get into the management of savagery, which is characteristic of today. The other day I was talking to a group of, I thought, friends at a table in Switzerland, and the Swiss lady said to me, "You will forgive me for asking, it's a very embarrassing question, are you really an Arab Muslim?" And I said, "Yes, madam, I am, but why all the embarrassment?" And she said, "Because you're normal." So I want to say a few words to dispel some of the stereotypes that seem to abound in this world. And to start by saying that the declaration called for the following: in the liberated Arab countries, there will be established constitutional governments with internal independence, above which shall be a general constitutional government headed by the king. The reference, of course, was to King Faisal I, who met Chaim Weizmann in Paris in 1918. And the concept of federalism of those days, at the time when the Jews were resident in one-fifth of fertile Palestine, was rather forward-thinking for the time. And I wanted to point out that the joint constitution, which shall guarantee the rights of all the communities of various faiths, and the general ties that shall exist between governments, shall be established by a general parliament. So today, when we are patronized by those who want us to develop democracy and democratic institutions, this was an authentic cry and appeal from the peoples of the region. The interest of states, this is the third point, with economic relations with the country shall be honored, and Great Britain, the friend of the Arabs, shall enjoy a priority in this respect. Now, I don't know if Ian Black is among us, but I just wanted to reassure him when he refers to Nicholas Pelham and the excellent review of pluralism in the Middle East, Pelham being an economist, is definitely a step towards recognizing that ethnicity and sectarianism are richness in diversity, or could be, if the bridge between, and I return to David Howell, between the Greens and the Blacks. I don't want to advertise your book. I'm sure it's been very well circulated, Lord Howell, but I do want to say that the title of his book is The Clash of Empires, The Greens versus the Blacks. And when I think of it, I think immediately of Gertrude Bell, The Desert and the Sown. What we need to see in our part of the world, regardless of whom or who is ruling in whichever particular cabbage patch, because, I mean, that's terribly important to people in office. I was in office, so I know how important it is. But what is important, or more important, is how can we manage regional commons? And these regional commons, I would like to emphasize once again, are based on a sharing of values. The ideas behind the Arab revolt, as Suleiman Bustani, the Christian writer and scholar, put it, fikra wa ibra, a thought and a meaning, this was the late 1900s, before any drop of blood was spilt, as well as throughout the war and the struggle, which continues to the present day, is essential to understanding the story of those ideas and the intellectual history behind them. Of course, people say, the Arab revolt, T.E. Lawrence. Well, I sat under the photograph of T.E. Lawrence for a year as a visiting fellow in All Souls, and appreciate the tremendous qualities of T.E. Lawrence, and of course I salute his integrity. But at the same time, if one thinks of Louis Massignon walking into Jerusalem with T.E. Lawrence after Allenby's successful march to Jerusalem, I wonder how he got there. Were we not instrumental in bringing about this victory? And if we talk about Orientalists and anthropologists as they were in their early formation, what about Max von Oppenheim, for example, who was one of the outstanding Orientalists of the day? But I would like to say that from an Arab point of view, what is important is to live on, to have this idea of self-determination living on in the minds and the dreams of people to inspire them to achieve their aspirations. Self-determination, which is a right and not a gift to be bestowed by outside powers, however influential and however well-meaning. However unfinished and imperfect the work is, it goes on, whether this is recognized by the wider world or not. I recognize among you somewhere Tony Klug from the Oxford Research Group, and I recognize his work in calling for an international protectorate for Palestinians, particularly at a time when we are being told that the one-state solution should be within some kind of federalism. I want to make it very clear that as far as the Palestinians are concerned, whether it is the Hashemite monarchy to their east, or the State of Israel to the West, these two entities cannot blinker for much longer the right of the Palestinians to self-determination. After all, it was a right for which my great-grandfather, Sharif Hussein ibn Ali, dedicated his life, traveled to Cyprus, I was speaking to the ambassador a minute ago, in exile, largely because he said no to the exploration of oil until these rights are recognized. So we go back, of course, to the green and the black. Maybe the green and the black were at the genesis of this whole conflict. So once again, I want to say that as our region is blighted by stereotypes and preconceived ideas and a failure to put the text into the context, a plethora of disaster headlines comes to mind. I call it the alphabet soup, the acronyms used to define PFP, Partnership for the Mediterranean, Partnership for Peace, OSC, META, Middle East Treaty Organization, I wish, WANA, West Asia, North Africa, MENA, Middle East, North Africa. Of course, from Japan, we're not Middle East at all, we're Middle West. In fact, I sometimes say Wild West. But the attempts to define and simplify not only seek to homogenize a gloriously diverse region, but promulgate two-tiered notions, namely that any event in the Middle East is either habitual or unprecedented or both. Even those who seek historical context miss the point. The story did not begin in 1916, nor has it ended in 2016. I hope that if those of us who live to see 2018 or our children and their grandchildren will one day see a revisiting of a regional conference with international guarantees. But I do want to emphasize that if the story is about self-determination and not diktat, I'll tell you the story of diktat as I'm approaching my anecdotage. Mrs. T, in a conversation, God rest their souls, with my late brother, was lecturing him in magnificent Thatcherite manner. And at one point he said to her, Madam Prime Minister, in everything that you have heard here today, is there the remotest possibility that you might have got it wrong? And she said, well, yes. He said, on that basis, maybe we can now have a conversation. So I do believe that the noble art of conversation is a two-sided exercise of speaking and listening. And that's why I look forward to rabbiting through this and then listening to you and commenting. But I just want to say that the last 100 years are certainly indicative of the continuity of the aspirations of the people of our region in their humanitarian, and I stress humanitarian, call for dignity. When I had this conversation with Leopold Senghor years ago, a far more skilled linguist than myself, member of the French Academy, I'm only a foreign member of the Academy, overseas member, he said, why don't you say humanist? And I said, well, humanist will lead to laïc. And laïc will lead to atheist. So what's in a word? Why don't we call it humanitarian? Why can human rights not be a part of the package of rights? 1951 Convention on Refugees, however, is one of our sadnesses. It is, in theory, in force, but it is not operational. And this reminds me of Hans Blix's remarks a few days ago in Moscow when he said CTBT is operational but not in force. And you will appreciate the difference. So framing the deplorable violence that has ensued in the wake of the Second Arab Awakening as habitual or routine is, I fear the lazy option of perhaps to be cynical, a byproduct of past imperialisms, more importance should be given to instill an acceptance that opens the way to disaster and makes possible the risk of inhumanity triumphing. So 2016 is the centennial anniversary year of the Arab Revolt, or as some would call it, the Arab theater of the Great War. While this was an important and heroic time, what really matters then and now is not the bullets, nor even the protests, but the idea. Too often, militarized conflict is seen as the sole narrative in understanding the wider region. But the revolt, the Nahda, Tahrir Square, Dar'a, were and are not mere revolutions of arms, but of the mind. For those of us attempting to predicate the future on the primacy of human dignity, and I certainly am one of them, I believe in waging peace, it is worth remembering that the struggle for human dignity, far from being unprecedented, is the story of civilization. Seen in this light, the first Arab awakening represents a moment when giants of our shared human experience took up the torch of human dignity. And, of course, I salute the memory of King Faisal I, my great uncle, the founder of the Kingdom of Syria and consequently and subsequently the Kingdom of Iraq, my grandfather, Amir Abdullah, later King Abdullah of Transjordan. And I was particularly touched the other day by, on YouTube, watching Princess Badia, the daughter of King Ali, who still resides in this great capital, addressing the Iraqi people, an old lady in her late 90s in a black gown of mourning, saying to the Iraqi people, "What have you achieved? What have you achieved by killing the boy king in the square in 1958? And this is this sadness, that people simply don't seem to understand that there is a human interaction between the peoples of our part of the world, that the light of their ideas still shines, and that these ideas will not be dimmed by the inevitability of realpolitik. Al-Fatah and freedom movements of the First Awakening in the early 19th century, as the Ottoman polity struggled with the new, narrow definitions of the nation-state on the one hand, while finding itself pitted literally against the subtle and not so subtle battles between the great powers to control resources on the other, the mood in the region was as conflicted as it is today, swithering between a desire to reform and modernize and to preserve and regenerate the ancient traditions that had sustained the empire for so long. Gatherings that had been inspired initially by a shared love of our rich cultural and literary history became suspect and subversive as the 20th century opened and Ottoman policy shifted toward greater Turkish primacy. I am the grandson on my mother's side of a member of the Ottoman parliament. And when I went to a parliamentary session some years ago, parliamentarians, Turkish parliamentarians, said to me, "Why do the British always talk about our empire and their commonwealth? The millet system was a form of commonwealth. When did representatives of India sit in the British parliament?" And I said, "Well, maybe you have a point. But the point today is that the Turkic, the Turanian influence is growing." I hadn't predicted modern Turkey today as we see it, but I wanted to say that attempts to curtail Arab freedom and independence provoked anger and frustration, raising the question of other basic rights and liberties. There was a vacuum that had to be filled, that many of the nations that lived under the Ottoman state felt the time had come when in 1908 Yıldız Palace was occupied by the Young Turk movement. If you are familiar with Al-Fatah, you may recall them as the main political and intellectual force in the short-lived Syrian state of Emir Faisal. As a political party, however, though united in principles, they disagreed on tactics. Familiar theme. Some supported a balanced and practical policy, while others called for action to achieve complete independence regardless of the cost. My great uncle on my mother's side raised the flag on the Serai in Beirut and was the last governor of Huran, southern Syria. And he said to my grandfather after the Battle of Maysalun, when the French inevitably broke the Arab lines, "I will fight to the last soldier." And my grandfather said to him, I don't know what exactly he said to him, but basically he sent him the following stern message: "If you are chased by the French out of Syria, there is no British guarantee that they will hold the line of what today is Ramtha or Deraa," rather approximating the line that our soldiers are holding today with 7 kilometers depth to prevent tunneling and indiscriminate killing. Anyway, a British officer was to describe their movement and the atmosphere in their capital, Damascus, as follows. My grandfather, by the way, King Abdullah, Emir Abdullah, was on the march towards Damascus. So when people talk to us about reaching Damascus or bringing normality to Baghdad, you'll forgive us if it rings certain bells in our family history. But anyway, the description went, a small party consisting mainly of fanatical Muslims and young Arab hotheads desires a purely Sharifian government and displays a certain anti-European sentiment. Dear, dear. So what did these young fanatics and hotheads of Al-Fatat and like-minded organizations like Al-Ahd stand for? In brief, they called for political rights for their community, self-determination, intellectual and cultural freedom, and for the protection of and respect for minority rights. If such policies appear to reflect current concerns, it is because they do. Let me emphasize one crucial point about Al-Fatat. They reflected centuries of pluralist cultural cohesion in the region, and I'm glad to say that in Amman I have been able to republish the Qibla newspaper, which was published in Mecca in 1916. So now you have an early account, a recollection of those early days. But going back to the desert and the zone, I want to make it very clear, in particular to my Saudi friends or their friends, or maybe here in the audience, that there is absolutely no case to be made for antipathy between Hashemite and Saudi. And I just want to say that, once again, whoever rules that part of the world has to be aware of the fact of the basic lack of complementarities between neighboring communities. In Benelux, they call it intra-independence. And the call for Arab independence was a call for intra-independence, to recognize the importance of the Kurd and the Druze and all of these figures who came together to form the Al-Ahd and the Fatat, Al-Fatat of those days. Nationalism is not a policy. It speaks of identity and giving effect to the sentimental quest of discovering and asserting who we are as peoples and groups. And I think from the Shukri Quwatli period, the Nasser period, the Ba'ath period, we have had examples of nationalism to the point of the two Ba'ath parties fighting each other. I met Michel Aflaq years ago, and we had this conversation. I said to him, Wahda Hurriya Ishtirakiya, unity, freedom, socialism. What do you mean by it? Wahda and Hurriya, unity and freedom, is what was called for by the Sharif Hussein ibn Ali, and socialism is a movable feast in today's politics. And he said, well, we were recognized for it. A bit like Zulfiqar Ali Bhutto, when I met him when he had just come into office. We sat for 1 hour together, and I tried to dissuade him of the idea of Islamic socialism. Nasser had advertised Arab socialism. I said, socialism is socialism. Leave Arab and Islamic out of it. Anyway, the same answer. So many million people voted for it, of course, voted for it. It was the era, of course, of Woodrow Wilson's 14 points, when, like democratization today, nationalism in a North Atlantic sense would be the sword that sliced the Gordian knot of the tangled world of empires to benefit free peoples everywhere. To Al-Fatat, nationalism meant independence and self-determination, as such, the foundation of all political and individual rights. In that tradition, we continue today to take satisfaction in including the right of respect, the right to respect into international law, to yearn for a day where a law of peace could be written into international humanitarian law, to yearn for a day where it is not only Henri Dunant's call for humane wars or making war more humane that counts, but actually doing something about developing a new order, possibly a humanitarian order. So I feel that 100 years from 1916, Sharifian leadership has called for ideas of just and tolerant society. The explanation can be found in these shared ideas. The idea of independence has a strong legacy in the Middle East. The allegiance of the House of Beni Hashim to the centers of empire in Baghdad, Cairo, and Istanbul through the ages has always been restless and grudging. Successful world powers have sought to control the holy sites of Islam on the pretense that possession would equate legitimacy. And as I say once again, the House of Saud is dominant in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, are the protectors of Islam. But once again, I would like to say that the importance of the noble art of conversation, of consultation, should not be missed, not at this time. I've just flown in from Rome, where in a meeting at the Pontifical Council, I had the privilege of leading a Shia-Sunni delegation. So this is the universality that we seek. And this is the third meeting of its kind. For a time, my grandfather lived in Istanbul, where his father, the storied Sharif Hussein, to whom I refer, had been to all intents and purposes exiled for opposing injustice and oppression in the Hejaz, instigated from Istanbul by Ottoman policy. Despite the relationship with the High Porte and even greater friction with the Young Turks Committee of Union and Progress, the Hashemites had the duty incumbent from their position. They were and had always been responsible for the safety and security, physical and spiritual, of the millions of pilgrims from across the globe. Their interests and views were anything but parochial. How can you be parochial with the lineage of 1,000 sharifs of Mecca behind you? Islam holds that differences among human beings are willed by God. The Holy Quran tells us, had your Lord pleased, he would have united all mankind. So I would like to conclude by suggesting, in the words of the Prophet Muhammad, that all people are equal. There is no claim of merit of an Arab over a non-Arab, or of a white over a black person, or a male over a female. Only God-fearing people merit a preference with God. Now, interfaith conversations are not interfaith at all, because texts are not in dialogue. They are conversations between the adherents of faith, and in that sense, I also want to add, of no faith at all, so long as they are people of integrity. Today, it's a long 100 years during which we have sought kindred spirits in patriotic movements and free societies. And yet we are split between Islamism on the one side, maybe Christianity is also aware of the rising power of the rapture crowd, extremist Christians who believe that their object in life is to expedite the arrival of the end of days. And I don't know whether the deity to whom we all look would be best pleased by seeing those who were responsible for the killing of so many millions of people claiming special privileges, any more than they would be best pleased by the excesses of whatever the name is today. I hate to use the term Islamic State because I don't see anything Islamic about it. And I think that we are falling into their trap when we accept their brand name. But I do think that between the Haredim on the one side and the extremists on all sides, that it is very difficult to make the case for rationalism. Nationalism on one side, extremism on the other. So I would like to go back to the Damascus Charter as saying it constituted a meeting of minds and a first step toward the international and domestic recognition of Arab demands. In conclusion, I would say that I have referred to part of the human story, not to just the Arab experience. And I would like to invite those of you with an emotional inclination to read the Requiem for the Arab Nation, as in the work of Adid Lawisha, 2003. But bear in mind that Qawmiyyah, tribal, ethnic, national, and Wataniyyah, homeland or native country, are two different concepts. I think that we are often in the trap of forgetting that in 1870, Francis Marache, the Syrian writer, placed special importance on the concept of homeland rather than nation when applied to Greater Syria. When I spoke to Hafez Asad all those years ago, he would say Greater Syria, and I would say Fertile Crescent. And I would say Greater Syria, Alik Ghafurun Rahim. It is acceptable for you to say this, and simply because you want Damascus to be in the ascendant. But why can't we talk about Fertile Crescent? Why can't we talk about a time when the three great countries of this extended region, Turkey, Iran, and Israel, if it were to accept the Palestine state, could not be a part of a truly resurgent Levant. Lever de soleil, where the sun rises. The wisdom of illumination, Hikmat al-Ishraq, as described by the Sufis, Sheikh Shihabuddin al-Sahrawardi, meeting the enlightenment. Not the enlightenment of moving from two legs to four to the speed of light, the enlightenment of matter, but the enlightenment of values. I would like to refer to all of the members of this Fatat and Ahd movement, many of whom became heads of state and prime ministers of independent Arab countries, such as Sa'adullah Jabri, such as Shukri al-Quwetli, such as Riyad al-Sulh, Zaki al-Tamimi, Husni al-Barazi, Adil al-Azm, Tawfiq al-Yazaji, and many others. Jamal al-Din Afghani, after all, of Afghan origin, but of Arab culture. Muhammad Abdu, I've referred to Suleiman Bustani, and I would also refer to the Sassons and the Morays and the Somechs, some of whom I had the pleasure of studying with at Oxford. We can be a rich region in our diversity, in our mutual respect, and I wonder whether the words of Chaim Weizmann when he met my great uncle in 1918 could be remembered. And I paraphrase, we should not do the Muslims a great injustice because they received us with open arms when they and we were expelled from Al-Andalus. Thank you for your patience, and I look forward to your questions.